Hey, good morning. Today we have Joseph Bowen. He's a lecturer in moral and political philosophy at the University of Leeds. And he's the director of the Center of Aesthetics, Moral and Political Philosophy. And his research focuses on rights and directed duties, the justification of liberal harming, duties of rescue, and just war theory. Except for this last issue, the reason why we invite him is because all the stuff he works on is of great interest to one of our research lines, which is the philosophy of private law. We have been reading, some of us, some of his previous stuff, and we like it a lot, and that's why we are having this seminar today. And today's seminar is entitled Owing Something to Another. Joe, thank you for coming to Girona, and the usual format is like 35, 40 minutes, 45 minutes, whatever you need to for the presentation, and then the rest of the time for the debate. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a real pleasure to be here. I'll jump straight in. So the paper's quite long, so sorry for those that read all of it. I'm not going to speak to every part of the paper in the presentation, but I'm very happy to talk about the Q&A. I'm just in the presentation. I'm going to try and touch on some of the bits I'm a bit less sure about, and so really looking forward to seeing what you think about it. Great. I also talk really quickly, so I'm going to try and not talk really quickly. But if you lose me, just give me a nod and I'll try and slow down. Okay, let me get a timer going just so I can see how long we're going. Okay, so some duties are undirected. They're not owed to anyone in particular. So, for example, duties of beneficence, duties to promote the good, and duties to care for the environment are undirected. However, some duties are directed. I think we probably stole this from tort law. They are owed to particular parties. So when I promise my friend something, I'm under a duty to satisfy the promise. And the promissory duty is directed towards, owed to my friend. So one might act morally wrongly by failing to satisfy either an undirected or a directed duty. And maybe I'll say as well, it's just not the case that directed duties are de facto more important. Undirected duties can be really important. But when one does act wrongly, it's important whether one has infringed a directed or an undirected duty for at least the following few reasons. So first, if I infringe a directed duty, I don't merely act wrongly, as I do when I infringe an undirected duty, but I wrong the person to whom I owe the duty. And because of this, there are some interesting normative upshots, normative consequences to this. So, for example, many people believe that directed duties are demandable by the person to whom they're owed. I can say to Hemi, you know, you owed it to me to meet me at 12 o'clock, say. Further, the person to whom the duties owed has special standing to blame and to forgive the person that's violated the duty that's owed to them. Looked at from the other direction, the duty bearer might be under directed, restitutive, reactive attitudes. They might be under a duty to feel remorse and apologise to the person. And if a duty's undirected, then none of these upshots follow. When you violate an undirected duty, there's no one to whom you owe an apology because you didn't owe the duty to anyone. Second reason why it's important to ask whether a duty is directed or undirected is that claim rights, the paradigm form of rights, entail directed duties. So there's some disagreement about whether all directed duties entail claim rights, but almost everyone holds that all claim rights necessarily entail directed duties. And this is important for two reasons. So first, we might think that claim rights are non-instrumentally important. So, for example, some people in moral philosophy think that the claim rights we hold are constitutive of or reflect our inviolability or a constitutive of what it is to be shown respect, is just for your rights to be respected. Second, rights are instrumentally important as well. So, for example, many people hold that only duties which are correlative to rights are enforceable, both before their violation in the form of being liable to defensive harm or liable to coercive measures, and after their violation in the form of compensation being owed. And what this means, if these people are right, is that a duty's being enforceable is a necessary condition. Sorry, a duty's being directed is a necessary condition on its enforceability. As it turns out, I now think that's wrong, but most people think I'm wrong in thinking that undirected duties can be enforceable, so it's still an interesting upshot. Undirected duties don't correlate with rights, so most people think they're not enforceable. I wish I hadn't written that paper. It's really ruined setting up why directed duties are enforceable. Okay, so what I'm going to do today is argue that a duty is owed to someone if that person's well-being, their interests, are the grounds of the duty. So this is a sufficient condition on a duty's directedness, and I call it the interest condition. I'm going to put forward a presumptive case for it in section 1 of the presentation and section 2 of the paper. I've realised this is going to make it really hard to keep track of where we're at. I sort of realised this on the plane after I'd sent the handoff. I was like, why have I done that? And then in section 2 of the handout, I'll look at a condition that's incompatible with the interest condition, but show why I think the interest condition's more plausible. And then I'm going to deal with some objections in the forms of counterexamples, most which suggest the interest condition's going to overgenerate, so it isn't actually a sufficient condition. And then section 5 in the presentation wonders whether the condition's going to be it's going to be redundant because there's going to be other conditions that do all the work of the interest condition. And then if I've got time, but hopefully I won't because I'll speak slowly enough, I'll say a bit about why I don't think the interest condition is necessary on owing someone a duty. Okay. So quick preliminary. One preliminary is, when I say duty, I mean that to be interchangeable with obligation. So nothing turns on using the word duty. Second, my interest is in moral directed duties today. And this is because, unlike some people like Matt Kramer, for example, I'm actually open to what makes something a directed legal duty being much more of a positivistic affair. So provided you satisfy whatever you need to do to create the legal duty, if you deem that it's also going to be a directed legal duty, I think it would be weird if you'd be a positivist about what makes it the case that there's a duty, but then not a positivist about what makes it the case that the duty is directed. I think that's something of a circle that Matt Kramer needs to square, and I'm not sure he can. But so I'd be really interested in talking about that in the Q&A, if anyone's got any thoughts. Moral duties today. Okay, section 1 of the presentation. So I think when offering an account of directed duties, we want to do at least 3 things. So first, we want to explain what it is to owe someone a duty, as that's a bit of an opaque statement, maybe less opaque to a bunch of lawyers, but still a bit opaque. Second, we want to explain why, when you infringe a directed duty, you wrong the person to whom you owed the duty, I think. And third, we want our account to have good extensional adequacy. It mightn't be, it needs to be perfectly extensionally adequate, but you don't want any glaring counterexamples, I think. Or at least, better the fewer glaring counterexamples you have. So with this in mind, here's the sufficient condition I'm going to be arguing for. So I'm going to unpack it first, and then I'll explain why I think it's right. So interest condition, 1.2 on the handout. Y's duty to phi is owed to X if, and in those cases, because X's well-being is the grounds of Y's duty. So Henry's duty not to harm Joe is owed to Joe if, and in those cases, because Joe's duty is the grounds of Henry's duty. So three bits of unpacking. So first, talk of grounds should hopefully be intuitive here. So someone else's duty is grounded in another person's well-being if the duty exists because of or in virtue of or due to one's well-being. So take some of the most important duties I think we're under. Duties not to kill or to torture or to rape people. Why do those duties exist? Well, one thought is that it'd be awful for one were those things to happen to one. And it's precisely because those things would be awful were they to happen to one that others are under duties not to do those things to one. That's sort of what I mean by saying their duties grounded in one's well-being. So second, so the interest condition is actually agnostic on when someone's well-being is of sufficient weight to place another person under a duty. It just says, when it does, then the duty is owed to someone. So for my own part, I assume some form of what's called moderate non-consequentialism. So for example, I hold that if you come across Peter Singer's drowning child, and all that would happen were you to go into the pond to save the child would be that you get a bit of a nasty cold, then even though it's costly to you, I think you're required, you'd be under a duty to go into the pond to save the child. Whereas if the cost to you will likely be fatal, maybe there's something in the water that children are immune to but is going to cause adults to die, then you wouldn't be under a duty to go into the pond to save the child. So I'm not a consequentialist, but I do think consequences matter sometimes. But the interest condition is compatible with views that are much less demanding and also much more demanding as well. So third, unpacking, and then I promise I'll tell you why I think the condition's plausible. So well-being consists of what makes one's life go well for one. Sometimes also referred to as welfare. Some people hold that a person's well-being is synonymous with their interests, so I'm tempted to hold this is right. Other people deny that. They think interests come apart from well-being. I think Feinberg probably, it's hard to know what Feinberg thinks, but I think Feinberg probably thinks one's welfare interests are a subset of one's interests generally. For those who think that interests come apart from well-being, they can read the interest condition as concerning interests. Or we can read the interest condition as concerning welfare or interests. Raz, notably, in The Morality of Freedom, when he defines the interest theory of rights, sort of formulates it in terms of well-being, but then calls it the interest theory, which sort of suggests that for Raz, at least, they're going to be synonymous. Okay. So much for unpacking the condition. Why hold that it's true? Well, recall my explanation of what it is for one's well-being to be the grounds of someone else's duty. So I asked why some of other people's most important duties, such as their duties not to kill, torture or rape you, might exist. And I said, it seems really plausible that those duties exist precisely because it would be awful for one were those things to happen to one. The interest condition adds to this, well, when that's the case, and because that's the case, then the duty's owed to you. And I just think this looks like a really plausible account of why someone would not merely be under a duty, but would owe you that duty. Another way to put the point is that when the antecedent of the interest condition is satisfied, when Y's duty is grounded in X's well-being, the duty bearer's duty owes its existence to the person to whom she owes the duty. And I think that sort of makes sense, right? It's because of me that you're under the duty not to kill me. And in virtue of its being because of me that you're under the duty not to kill me, that's why you owe it to me not to kill me. So I think we can bolster the significance of the significance of this for the interest condition by noting the importance both to the duty bearer and to the person to whom the duty is owed when the condition is satisfied. So it's almost definitional that X's well-being is of special significance to X, right? It's what makes her life go well for her. Now think about what it is to be under a duty, at least a moral duty, but I think maybe this follows for legal duties as well. First, one has reason, where reason's specific to the domain of normativity we're in, one has reason to fie corresponding to one's duty to fie, right? In virtue of having the duty to fie, you have reason to fie. Second, the reason's categorical as opposed to hypothetical, right? It demands something of you regardless of your attitudes towards it. And third, it's somewhat exclusionary in character, or preemptory, as some people want to call it, such that even if the reason's capable of being overridden, I gather you were talking about this the other day, right? Even if the reason's capable of being overridden, it takes a significant amount of countervailing good to override the reason. And I think, though this is maybe a bit more controversial, the duty and the reason, even when overridden, remain in existence as well. It's not like they go away. They're not undercut by the stronger reason. There's a remainder that's left. So from these three sort of structural features of a duty, I think we can note that being under a duty is no trivial feat for the duty bearer. And when the interest condition's antecedent satisfied, what that means is that this thing that's of special importance to X has been significant enough to give Y this special kind of reason, which is no trivial feat. And I think it's fitting that sort of the normative relationship there wouldn't just be one of being under a duty, but would be one of owing someone the duty. Okay. So I think the condition also offers a plausible account of why, if Y violates her duty, she doesn't merely act wrongly, but she wrongs X. So recall again, X's well-being is of special significance to X. When Y infringes a duty grounded in X's well-being, well then, Y's failed to respond to this morally salient duty grounding features about X that are of special significance to X. That looks to me like a really nice story of why Y wouldn't merely be acting wrongly, but would be wronging X. Y's failed to respond to this thing, which was really important, that's of special significance to X, and so she wrongs X. That's the thought. Okay. So I don't think there's too much more to say in general terms in defense of the interest condition. So I've explained it's got good explanatory power and bolstered this by highlighting the importance of one's well-being to one and what it means to be under a duty. Whether we should ultimately endorse the interest conditions, I think, is going to depend on two further things. First, how its explanatory power compares to the explanatory power of other theories, which I'll compare it with in the following section. And second, how its extensional adequacy compares to other theories, which I'm going to do throughout the remainder of the paper. So let's turn to that now. Okay, so section two of the handout demanding section three of the paper. So one might object to the interest condition because they think there are other necessary conditions on being owed a duty, conditions that aren't guaranteed to be satisfied just because one's well-being has grounded someone else's duty. So for example, one might endorse the following account, what I call the demand account. So Y's duty to Phi is owed to X if and only if and because X has standing to demand that Y Phi's. So the thought here is that well, just because your well-being has been the grounds of someone else's duty, that doesn't automatically show that you've got standing to demand that the person performs the action that the duty requires them to perform. But you only have a directed duty, according to the demand account's necessary part, if you have the standing to demand that the person performs the action. So the sufficient condition of the interest condition can't really be a sufficient condition. obviously, if the demand account was just a sufficient condition, and so it was just an if rather than a if and only if, then it would be compatible with the interest condition. Both could just be sufficient conditions. I mean, that might be right. So an initial problem with the demand account, which I've written about in previous work in relation to the will theory of rights, is that it can't accommodate owing duties to those with undeveloped, compromised, or damaged rational capacities. So, for example, very young children, people with severe mental disabilities, people suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Right? Because these people are unable to demand actions of others, because they can't, it doesn't make sense to ask, I think, if they've got standing to demand those actions. Now, one might be thinking, someone who's asleep while they're asleep is unable to demand. But it still makes sense to say that they've got standing to demand actions from others, doesn't it? And so this shows that it might be that you're unable to demand but can have standing to demand. You know, similarly, if you were to duct tape my mouth, right, I'd be unable to demand that you take the duct tape off, but I've still got standing to demand that you take the duct tape off. But I think the difference here is that if the sleeping person were to wake up or you were to take the duct tape off, it'd be really easy to demand. Someone whose cognitive capacities are limited or a baby, they're unable to demand in a more modally robust way. It's not like if things were just a little bit different, they'd be able to demand, as it is in the sleeping case. The world we need to go to in which they're able to demand is really far away, right? It's the world in which either babies have cognitive capacities such that they can demand and talk to people, or we go to the world in which they've grown up and then they demand, and that's a really far away, modally speaking. So I think it's these instances in which one's inability to demand is sort of modally robust, where one has no standing. This leads to a second thought. One might be thinking, well, why not just say that babies have standing but are unable to exercise it? But this seems to me a bit ad hoc, right? So for the demand account to be true, there needs to be some reason why having the standing to demand others' actions is important. And it just can't have this value for babies because they're unable to demand. So I just don't think it makes sense to say that they've got standing to demand. So there's further cases. So this is 2.2.2 on the handout. So I think there are further cases that put pressure on the idea that it's necessary for one to be owed a duty that one has standing to demand. One might have lost that standing, for example, because one's a hypocrite. But that doesn't stop it from being the case that one owes the person a duty.
Oh, I've taken my thing off.
Or perhaps it might be, and this is now top of page 2 of the handout, perhaps it might be that one never had the standing to demand because it's the sort of duty that requires voluntary performance, and so if you're able to demand it, that would undermine the value of the duty or the existence of the duty. So some people think this is true of duties of gratitude or duties of friendship. But that doesn't prevent them from being owed as well, I think. So there might be ways to accommodate these counterexamples, but I don't really want to examine them here. Instead, what I want to do is sort of use these counterexamples to sort of like press a more general objection. And that's, even if the demand account could be revised to be extensionally adequate, I just think it's got the order of explanation the wrong way around. The reason it seems, I think, an open question whether one has standing to demand actions required by duties owed to one, I think is because it's an upshot, it's a consequence of being owed a duty that one has that standing. That's to say, when one has standing to demand an action from someone else, it's because that person owes one a duty to perform that action that one gets the standing. But this upshot's capable of misfiring, and that's why we get these potential counterexamples, I think. So let me formalize this preceding idea before then explaining why I think it's plausible, right? So what I'm arguing for here is what I'm calling the demand upshot, which is at the bottom of 2.3. So absent a defeater or a disabler, X has standing to demand of Y that Y-phi if and in those cases, because Y owes X a duty to phi. Right? Why do I have standing to demand of you that you keep your promise? Well, because you owe it to me to keep your promise. Why do I get to demand that you not barge past me? Well, because you owe it to me not to barge past me. This seems really natural to my eye. And what's nice is that it explains why sometimes we might be owed a duty but not have standing to demand it, because this upshot can misfire. Okay. So let's relate all this back to the interest condition. So I've argued that the demand account fails. It's not a necessary condition of a duty's being owed to one that one has standing to demand the action required by the duty. Instead, what I think is appealing about the demand account is that absent defeaters, one gets standing to demand duties owed to one because those duties are owed to one, sort of like baked into the notion of being owed a directed duty. But this leaves it open why one is owed a duty, and that's the question: why is it that duties are owed to people that the interest condition answers, right? So while the demand account was incompatible with the interest condition, I think the demand upshot is really consistent with it. And so I don't think this stuff about demanding actually causes trouble for the interest condition. Okay, so in the remainder of the paper, I'm going to consider further objections to the interest condition. Section 3 and section 4 of the presentation will suggest that the interest condition overgenerates directed duties. Section 5 is going to suggest that the interest condition is going to undergenerate directed duties as a sufficient condition, and so it's going to be redundant. And then, as I said, if we have time, I'll say why I don't think the interest condition should be read as necessary and sufficient. Okay, third-party beneficiaries. I've never ran this bit by anyone, so I'm interested to see what you all think. So I said in section 1 that the grounds of duties should be pretty intuitive. I said someone else's duty is grounded in one's well-being if that duty exists because of, in virtue of, or due to one's well-being. Now, perhaps one might object to the interest condition along similar lines that people like H.L.A. Hart, Hillel Steiner have objected to the interest theory of rights, by saying that the interest condition is going to imply that some duties are owed to third-party beneficiaries of the duty. So, for example, suppose that Anne promises Ben that she'll look after Ben's mother, who's called Carla. Doesn't Anne's promissory duty exist because of, in virtue of, due to Carla's well-being here? Doesn't this imply that the promissory duty is owed to Carla? But with people like Hart, that strikes me as counterintuitive. I think the duty is owed to Ben, the person to whom she made the promise. Now, in reply, I think the interest condition needn't imply that the duty is owed to Carla. And this is because Carla's well-being doesn't directly ground, where directly is in italics there, doesn't directly ground Anne's duty. Its direct grounds are Anne's promise, which incidentally enjoins Anne to watch out for Carla's well-being. But it could have enjoined Anne to do almost any morally permissible thing. And so what I'm suggesting is that the interest condition should be limited to saying that duties are owed to those whose well-being directly grounds them, not when your well-being indirectly grounds it, as in the case of Carla. Now, limiting the interest condition in this way, I think, isn't just an ad hoc response to try and defend the condition. Rather, when Carla's well-being indirectly figures in the grounds of Anne's duty, it's not the case that Anne is under this duty because of the importance to Carla of Carla's well-being. Rather, she's under the duty because of the promise. And remember in section one, I said, I think we should endorse the interest condition because of the importance to the person to whom the duty is owed of their well-being, right? So it's because I'm trying to link the significance of one's well-being with the plausibility of the interest condition, I think we can limit ourselves to worrying about direct grounds here. Now, I think as a way of bearing this out, there are a small range of third-party beneficiary cases or third-party beneficiary adjacent cases in which I think the interest condition is satisfied and so the duty is owed to the third-party beneficiary. But I don't think those are counterexamples. So suppose that Anne promises Ben that she'll look after his child, Dana. Dana's only a baby, and so is going to be dependent on Anne while she's in Anne's care. I think Anne owes it to Ben to look after Dana because of the promise, but I also think that Anne owes it to Dana to look after Dana, given the reliance on Anne that Anne's promise has induced. So I think this duty is akin to a duty of aid. It's a bit like saving the baby from the drowning, from the pond, the drowning pond. It's a bit like saving the baby from the pond, though one that Anne's partly responsible for bringing about in virtue of the promise, so I think the costs that one could be required to bear are going to be even greater. So to see this, and to see why I think this isn't actually implausible, suppose that Anne hasn't actually promised Ben that she'll look after Dana, but Ben falsely believes that she has. Suppose Anne comes by Ben's house to borrow a book, and she finds a note on the kitchen table saying, "Thanks for promising you'll look after Dana. She's asleep upstairs. She needs to be fed at 4 o'clock, right? In this case, Anne doesn't owe it to Ben to look after Dana because of the promise, because there wasn't a promise. But if Dana's going to be in danger, were Anne just to leave, and if looking after Dana isn't too costly for Anne, well, then I think Anne's under a duty to stay and look after Dana. And notice this duty is grounded by the good for Dana that looking after Dana will do. And so I think the interest condition is going to imply that this duty is owed to Dana. But that doesn't strike me as implausible in this case, because I think it just looks like a duty of aid, and I think some duties of aid can be directed. Which leads me nicely to section four, which focuses more directly on duties to aid. So take the following objection from Laura Valentini. So Laura says, "Consider my duty to assist an elderly lady who's struggling to cross the street. If I'm uniquely positioned to help her and can do so at very little personal cost, I ought to do it. Yet most people would deny that the lady has a claim right to be helped by me in the same way. Say, my baker has a claim right that I pay for the bread rolls I bought from him this morning." So Laura's objecting to the interest theory of rights, but we can see how her objection is going to apply to the interest condition as well. Right, one's duty, Laura's duty to aid the old lady is grounded in the old lady's well-being, but you might think it's counterintuitive that the duty's owed to the old lady. Now, I've sort of got an argument in the alternative to the lawyer's favourite trick, I've been told, to respond to Laura here. So I think while she begins by asking us to consider our duty to assist the old lady, the following sentence switches to talk of the fact that you ought to help the old lady. And the problem here is that that you ought to do something doesn't imply that you're under a duty to do it. Or at least it doesn't in English. It'd be interesting to know about Spanish, actually. And this is because ought attaches to both obligatory and supererogatory actions. Right? You both ought to perform actions that you're under a duty to perform, and you ought to perform actions that are supererogatory. But that by hypothesis, you're not required to perform. Right, those are actions that do good, but actions that you're not required to do. And helping old ladies is often thought to be a supererogatory action, right? So the problem, as I see it, is that Valentini might be pointing to a case in which helping the old lady is supererogatory. And if it's supererogatory, well then the old lady's well-being hasn't placed one under a duty to help the old lady, so the interest condition wouldn't imply that that duty is owed to the old lady, because there's no duty to be owed to the old lady. Simpliciter. Now, Valentini might reply by suggesting, as she has done to me, and as her first sentence specified, no, it's not supererogatory. You really must help. That's why I said consider your duty to help the old lady. But on the one hand, this doesn't stop it from being the case that it's characteristically supererogatory to help old ladies. And so this might be why it's striking as intuitively implausible. So that's an error theory for the intuition there. And on the other hand, if you really must help, I just don't find it implausible to think that you owe it to the old lady to help, right? I think the old lady can say to you, if you're not going to help her, come on, young man, help me across the road here. Morality's deemed that you're required to, in virtue of how important it would be for me were you to help me. Okay. So let me go for a few more minutes. Yeah, so I'll do explanatory redundance and then I'll maybe miss the why not necessity. Because I think this is a really cool objection. I'd be interested to see what you think. So here's a final objection. So suppose that my life is no longer going to be worth living for me. Ahead of me is little but suffering and pain. In this case, my well-being isn't going to place anyone under a duty not to painlessly kill me. Because it wouldn't be bad for me were others to painlessly kill me. And this prompts a question for defenders of the interest condition. Do others nonetheless owe it to me not to kill me? Well, one thing you might reply is, yeah, no, since my life has no value for me, others don't owe it to me not to painlessly kill me. They might still be under a duty not to do so, but it's just not a duty that's owed to me. But that strikes me as counterintuitive. So instead, what I think we should reply is, yes, other people still owe it to me not to kill me. But remember, guys, the interest condition is merely a sufficient condition on owing someone a duty. It's not a necessary condition. Some other condition must explain why you owe it to people not to painlessly kill them when killing them is not going to be bad for them. But at this stage, our objector might really stick the knife in and say, well, if that's true, then the interest condition's just going to become redundant, right? Whatever explains why others owe it to me not to kill me, even when my life has no value for me, is also going to explain why others owe it to me not to kill me when my life has loads of value. Right? And so whatever cases you think the interest condition is going to be explaining, Joe, that's just going to be explained by this other condition you're appealing to here to respond to the objection. So what to say in reply? So I think what we should say in reply is we should just resist the objector's pressing that this makes the interest condition redundant. So we're supposing that something makes it the case that we owe it to others not to painlessly kill them, even when their life isn't going to continue being valuable for them. So for sake of argument, let's call whatever this is, whatever grounds this duty, the fact that they're a bearer of moral status. That's obviously going to be a placeholder. Something else is going to have to fill in why that's important. But let's just say, yeah, you owe it to people not to painlessly kill them when their life's not of value to them because they're bearers of moral status. My question now is, does that stop it from being the case that we're also under duties not to kill people when indeed it'd be bad for them were we to kill them because it'd be bad for them? And I just don't think so. That is, I think the grounds of the duty here are overdetermined. To fail to recognise that one of the reasons why we owe it to this person not to kill them, when it'd be bad for them, for us not to kill them, to fail to recognise that one of our reasons not to kill them is that it would be bad for them were we to kill them, I think would be to fail to tell the full moral story of what's going on here. So I think the grounds of the duty might be overdetermined, and then I'm just tempted to press, well, why not think the directedness of the duty is also overdetermined. We've sort of got two stories about why the duties directed in this case. So I think one way to see this is that the fact that the grounds of the duties overdetermined might have consequences, and so then I think this gives us good reason to think that the fact that the duties directed is overdetermined might have consequences as well. So suppose a trolley is headed towards 100 people. You can divert the trolley either to a track on the left on which victim 1's trapped, or a track on the right on which victim 2's trapped. Victim 1's future is full. It's going to be a very well-being full continued existence, whereas victim 2's continued existence won't be good for them. Let's suppose they're nearing the end of the life and they have a degenerative disease that they're going to be suffering more and more. So most people, at least in moral philosophy, think that you might be permitted to turn the trolley in this case. You have a lesser evil justification. But I think if you're going to turn the trolley, you should clearly turn the trolley towards victim 2 and not victim 1. And I think that this is explained by noting that your duty not to harm victim 2 is less weighty than your duty not to harm victim 1. Right, because you owe it to both of them not to kill them because they're bearers of moral status, but you also owe it to victim 1 not to kill them because it'd be really bad for them were you to kill them. And that's what explains why you should divert the trolley towards victim 2. Okay, so far I've suggested even if something explains why we owe it the duty not to kill people when our killing them wouldn't be bad for them, this doesn't mean that grounding the duty in its being bad for them becomes redundant. And now to return to the interest condition, what I'm going to suggest here is why not think that what explains the duty's directedness is also overdetermined. Sure, perhaps we owe it to people not to painlessly kill them because they're bearers of moral status, whatever that means. But it's also important that we owe it to people not to kill them when it would be bad for them were we to kill them, because it would be bad for them were we to kill them. So just as the grounds of the duty might be overdetermined, so too might the grounds of the duty's directedness be overdetermined too. Right, I'm at 40 minutes, so I'm going to stop there. I'm really interested to hear what questions you all have. Thanks so much. Thank you.